And welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. And I'm Phil Taylor. With me is Phil Conlon. How are you doing,
yes,
Phil?
Yes, good afternoon, Phil.
And by the way, Conlon does a wonderful program at Tuesday at 12 o'clock, right?
Yes, that's right.
I'm going to try this again.
Classical Underground.
Oh, you beat. See, it was supposed to be like a test. Yeah. I was supposed to see if I could do it. Okay. A couple of big items we're going to talk about today. We're going to be speaking to Toronto lawyer Chris Black about 10 minutes. There is a trial beginning in Ottawa of a man facing genocide charges. His name is Jacques Mungwari, and Chris Black has practiced law on the matter of Rwanda and international law, and particularly in Arusha, Tanzania, at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. We want to get his thoughts about similar trials being conducted in Canada and what the standards are and methods and what differences and similarities. And we have some announcements we better make, too, right off the bat. There's a Nakba Day solidarity rally in with Palestinian political prisoners on hunger strike, and that's going to be tomorrow, Tuesday, May 15, from 6 to 7 p.m. at the Israeli consulate, 180 Bloor Street West, Toronto, Bloor and Avenue Roads, and it's across from the ROM. That's a Nakba Day rally in solidarity with Palestinian political prisoners on hunger strike. It's organized by Palestine House and the Coalition Against Israeli Apartheid. I'll just give you a taste of some of their thoughts about behind this. May 15, 2012, Nakba Day commemorates the 64th anniversary of the ethnic cleansing of Palestine in 1947-48, when over 700,000 Palestinians were forced to leave their homes and over 300 Palestinian villages and towns were destroyed. This year, Nakba Day coincides with Day 28, and this is very important, Day 28 of the mass hunger strike for basic human rights by over 1,500 Palestinian political prisoners. And by the way, there are two individuals, and Bilal Diab, who have both been on hunger strike for 77 days, which is to say their lives are in danger. We've had a number of hunger strikes in recent times, where actually it's had quite a bit of impact, political impact, and now we have reached this point where there's 1,500. And just keep in mind that you've been reading front page stories in the New York Times about this, the Chinese gentleman, the doctor named Chen, a lawyer. They say he's a lawyer. And I happen to know he's also an escape artist who the U.S. Embassy helped out. And he got all sorts of publicity, and the American Congress fell all over itself to show how much they loved him, and all the millionaires of Texas who backing the Christian evangelicals who are his best friends. Talked about how brutal, et cetera, the Chinese government is, and here you have 1,500 Palestinians on hunger strike, and we're not getting the same kind of characterization of the people holding them. It seems to be a little different. But I would say this. They seem to share, the Israelis share Western values with the U.S. That is to say, they believe in incarcerating people without trial and torturing them, et cetera. So maybe that's what they all have in common. Incidentally, that Chinese lawyer, Mr. Chen, who is now going to be given a opportunity to study the United States, was actually called by the U.S. Congress, and he, from his hospital bedroom, he testified and spoke to them somewhat. He's not the most depressed guy. I don't think any of the 1,500 hunger strikers of Palestinians are getting any calls from the United States Congress. Just keep that in mind, and that's why you got to show up. Nakba Day rally at solidarity with Palestinian political prisoners on hunger strike. That's Tuesday, tomorrow, May 15, 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. in the Israeli consulate, 180 Bloor Street West. And Phil, I think you have an announcement as well.
Yes, tomorrow is International Day of Conscience Objection. And there are terrible problems right now in Canada with U.S. war resistors from the U.S. forces who are trying to stay here. The minister has adopted kind of a super bureaucratic policy of just interfering in their applications. So go to resistors.ca, www.resistors.ca, and they will tell you about all the activities planned for tomorrow. We're asking people to contact Minister of Immigration Jason Kenney and ask them to change their approach to U.S. war resistors in Canada.
Yeah. Oh, and one other important detail I want to make sure I mention before we get to speak to Chris Black, and that is there's been another loss amongst the troops who've been fighting for freedom on this continent. John Harris, who was a member of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and one of those who risked his life at the in the Freedom Summer when African Americans challenged, and of course many other Americans challenged an official state-sponsored segregation, I shouldn't call it sponsored, law, segregation, apartheid in America, and it had to be broken, and it, of course, only could be broken by people challenging it and putting their lives on the line. They, in this instance, they were registering people to vote so that they could exercise their rights as Americans, something that allegedly they won at the end of the American Civil War. It had only been 100 years later that they still could not vote. And many people were killed in this struggle. And John Harris, along with John Lewis and Stokely Carmichael and other names, were key people. And John was, I happen to know him personally very well, and a remarkable man. He lived in Birmingham. You all know, write me a letter in the Birmingham jail. Martin Luther King actually, I think one of the titles of his sort of book/pamphlets was Birmingham Jail, where they were holding him. Of course, that's also the town, the city in which the children were blown up by a terrorist bomb, and the federal authorities couldn't find anybody, as usual. But it all that led to a very important political breakthrough in America. So we want to mention that name, John Harris, and we're going to be. He and then some other former members of what they used to call SNCC, SNCC, Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, produced a very good book. Jim Dan is the author and a good close friend of John Harris. Probably in a week's time, we'll be talking to him. And I want to make a correction on a previous broadcast, and this is related to our interview with Chris Black. Last week on the program, I mentioned that Colonel Luke Marshall, who was a major figure in the events of in Rwanda in 1994. He was responsible for the city of security for the city of Kigali. He had UN responsibility. And I said that there had been a lawsuit brought against him by people who had lost family members and that they were seeking damages from Luc Marchal. I misspoke. I have since checked my facts and learned that it's actually a different type of action. We'll probably ask Chris about this, but the civilians from Rwanda have brought an action in a Belgian court, and they are claiming that the Belgian soldiers from the United Nations abandoned them in the early days of the war and massacres. Which is true, the Belgians left, and it's always been a subject of controversy as to who made the decision, why they made the decision. It certainly had consequences, and that's what it is about, which makes it, for us, a very interesting matter. We're going to be following it, and I'm sure Chris Black is, and I think we're joined on the line by Chris Black. Are you there, Chris?
Yes, I am.
Hey, thanks very much for joining us and for being patient through our early portions of the program. Can you talk to that? This action, were you aware this was going to be brought in Belgium? And your client, General Dindi Limana, he might end up as a witness or something. What do you make of this?
Right. I wasn't aware of it till I'm in touch with Colonel Marshall from time to time, as many people are. But he informed me he went through a court-martial himself after those events. He was charged in a court-martial with negligence. He was cleared on that charge, and that was an ordeal for him. Now, several civilians from Rwanda have launched a civil action for damages against him personally, and I think maybe a couple of other officers, for abandoning them at the so-called ETO school, technical college, where they allege that the Tutsis were killed and that the Belgians are responsible for that. So it's a civil action. I mean, Didi Lamana could be called as a witness if he can get back to Belgium.
Maybe this is a way, Chris.
Maybe it is a way.
He should be there. His family is there.
Yes. Now he's locked in exile in Tanzania.
And all sorts of people have actually complimented him, including General Dallaire has talked about how brave he was and how honorable.
Right. Even late Alison DeForge, everybody that spoke about General Didi Lamana, he's like, if there's a Schindler in the story, it'd be him. He was the man that saved all the Tutsis.
Mm-hmm.
And a so-called moderate, if you use that terminology.
Yes. Yes, although, of course, because of European politics, people who wanted to call him bad names wanted him brought there to the ICTR and destroyed his family, destroyed his life.
Right.
By the way, I hope you agree, this is a tragedy that will not end in our generation. This is just going to keep unfolding, isn't it?
It looks that way because now you have trials expanding into Europe and North America, Canada, the United States, of this hunt for Hutus allegedly involved in what they call the genocide goes on. It just amounts to persecution.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, to me, the whole purpose of it is to keep alive this propaganda of their version of events and to justify the domination of the minority or the RPF junta in Rwanda right now.
Yes. I think this is absolutely true, and it's worrying more and more people, I notice, who are starting to feel kind of bad about this because early on there was almost a broad consensus about the narrative. But people with direct knowledge, historians, journalists, and, of course, politicians in various countries are remembering things a little differently
right. And
understand the consequences. I want to tie this into the issue of the trial that is beginning in Ottawa of Mr. Mungwari. And I'll remind our listeners, this is the Taylor Report in CIUT 89.5 FM, and we're speaking to Christopher Black, a Toronto lawyer who has represented accused at the Hague and the ICTY and the ICTR, the Arusha. Chris, they've decided to bring charges against this man who was apprehended in Windsor.
Right.
A bunch of odd things about this case. He was transferred to Ottawa. Why that was necessary, I don't know. That put his family about 1,000 miles away.
Yes.
He's been held now quite a long time. And the court says that it is going to, the judge, that they're going to be very cautious about the circumstances of witnesses and whatnot. And I'm starting to hear echoes of the ICTR. And if I get... I get the impression that there's sort of they're passing over the approach taken by the ICTR where you represented accused and applying it here. Now, why is that automatic? I mean, I'm starting with the issue of witnesses with pseudonyms.
Well, it shouldn't be automatic. I can't understand why it's not being objected to. Production of the trials in the Rwanda War Crimes Tribunal, like the Hague, have been pure theater, and there's no reason for witnesses to testify under code names. There's no threat from the former regime or anybody they charge because they're all out of power and on the run or hiding their heads somewhere. There's no threat from any of them.
Mm-hmm.
The only threat is from the RPF government against defense witnesses.
Mm-hmm.
And yet we know that despite the fact that we were told we could use pseudonyms and have our witnesses kept secret, we now know that the tribunal was giving the Rwandan government the identity and the names and the addresses of all our defense witnesses for years. So it's just a farce. So why do they have it? It's just theater to make the accused look like they're dangerous.
Yeah. And by the way, doesn't that speak to the one of the first principles we all like to remind everybody which is that there's a presumption of innocence?
Not only a presumption of innocence, there's also a presumption that a man has a right to face his accuser and know who's accusing him. Mm-hmm. And so witnesses come and testify under a pseudonym. The defense lawyer might know who they really is, but the public doesn't. And the other thing that has a consequence is that if you know who a witness is and the press broadcast the events in the trial, and a witness says something, people know who it is. People in that locality can say, well, that's true or that's not true.
Yes.
So if they hear something, or that witness X, Mr. Jones, says this, well, I know Mr. Jones and I was in that town, that's not true, they can come forward and testify.
Yes.
By keeping those names secret, you deprive the defense of that possibility.
Oh, very important point. I mean, but incidentally, I mean, we know we all follow trials here, our big ones, and people make all sorts of commentary, which is quite either helpful or not, but at least it's all there in front of us.
Right.
They will say, well, you know, so-and-so actually belonged to a totally different religious denomination, and he lived in that neighborhood, and he was well-known for the following. Well, that kind of gets into your mind if you're trying to figure out what his motives might be, his behavior, or whether he would even be credible.
Yes, right.
Here we have letters of the alphabet talking about, you know, infinite numbers.
Yeah, and I'm hearing that many of the witnesses, if they're testifying, if they're brought to Canada, if these witnesses are from Rwanda being brought here, there's no danger in Canada. There's no secret former government hit squads running around Canada. That's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm.
And many of them will be testifying by video from Rwanda. There's no danger to them there because they all testify in the open Kachacha hearings. Everybody knows who they are.
Mm-hmm.
And most of these witnesses are Hutu prisoners who've been kept in prison without charge for 10 or 14 years and used as professional witnesses in order to get out of jail or better conditions in jail.
We've just been through this with the woman Victoire Ingabire,
right?
Who they put her on trial. They accused four other people. Along they say, well, we're not just charging you; we're charging these other four who happen to be in custody,
mm-hmm.
and who all say you're guilty.
Yes, right, right. In fact, in the Gacaca law. in Rwanda,
If we don't laugh, people will think you and I are crazy. You see,
yeah. Even in Rwanda, a person cannot plead guilty under the Gacaca law unless they name or finger it's 20 other people.
20. Yeah. It has to be 20.
So if they have maybe 100,000 people in jail, if each one fingers 20 people to confess and have their confession accepted, they finger the entire.
Which
tells
you you will have
entire population.
You will have a permanent government, right?
Because
there will always be accused people,
right,
who can be picked up at any time.
That's right. So it's a means of controlling the population. If there's a constant state of terror there.
Yeah,
you can be fingered in it or arrested at any time.
Yes. By the way, this is Christopher Black, and he represented General Dindilimana quite brilliantly at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. Of course, over many years, I should remark, one does get to sort of get Rwanda in the system, kind of like nickel dust,
right,
at a certain point. Chris, I got to ask you another feature of this matter of regarding the judge, for some reason, kind of taking on this. He wants to show how important the case is and project it to the journalists. You know, we're going to be very careful here, and we're going to use pseudonyms and do all this to protect everyone because we want to make sure everybody's safe. Now, another feature of Rwanda that you just referred to is the Gacaca proceedings.
Right.
Those are public, wide open proceedings where everybody sees everybody else. And they have Mr. Mungweri is from a village that has had several Gacaca proceedings.
Right.
Everybody in that village has to come,
mm-hmm.
and they all talk in front of each other. So. No one says, oh, I'm going to be A witness B, you be witness triple B, and what's his name across the street will be double XYZ.
Right.
No, they all know each other by name. So where is this pretense?
Exactly. And as I said before, it is a pretense. It's just pure theater. It's just to convince the Canadian public that this man's dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, you know, it takes away the presumption of innocence. It projects a view of the history of Rwanda, which is
and
a fantasy.
And it falsifies reality of Rwanda.
Falsifies reality of Rwanda.
If I was General Kagame's advocate, I'd say, what are you talking about? We just put Victoire Ingabire on trial, and all the names of everybody in the room was known.
Exactly.
What about their safety?
Yes. And now we have Mr. Mugesera going to face a trial, too. I mean, in contact with him recently. His trial is the preliminary parts of commencing, and he's going to have a public trial. No secret witnesses.
Everybody will be known there.
Yeah, sure.
So it's, in other words, we are now slipping down this road of developing a semi-secret trial.
Right, and if you allow it for this case, I mean, look at they say the man is charged with genocide, but he's not. He's charged with specific murders of several people in three different places. Mm-hmm. It's a murder trial. The motivation, they say, is to kill. He wanted to kill a certain people of a certain ethnic group, so it would be genocide, perhaps. Mm-hmm. But it's basically a murder trial. Now, if you're going to allow to have the prosecution, the government, to bring secret witnesses, the public doesn't know who they are, in this murder trial, then there's no stopping it in any other murder trial. Mm-hmm. So I do not understand why the defense is not objecting to this strenuously and saying, no, this cannot happen. The prosecution has to justify why they want this unusual procedure to take place.
Well, let me ask you about legal culture.
Although I think they did have brought motions in Rwanda to get witnesses who've recanted here to show how it's all been fixed up. So they have done something, but...
Incidentally, that was, of course, happened in the Ingabire case. I guess you know that... Mm. She attempted to bring one witness who was in prison with the other, her four accusers. And that witness came there to say those four were bribed. They had tried to bribe me, but I refused to be bribed. Mm. The judge, of course, didn't want to hear that. So, and incidentally, he also said, you can't be a full-fledged witness because you don't deserve that. You've been convicted of a terrible crime, therefore...
Yeah,
you can't be.
Well, it's happened in all the major trials at the War Crimes Tribunal where they had witnesses who've later recanted and said they were forced to testify falsely against the accused. Mm-hmm. And I know the defense in this case has brought motions before the ICTR to have that material presented to the case in the case here in Ottawa so that the jury or the judge can understand what's really going on. Mm-hmm. That hasn't been decided yet whether they're going to let them have that information or not. I supported that motion because we had a witness like that who recanted again, who said he was forced to testify falsely against General Dindili Amana.
Yes. And by the way, when you say these things, people might think, well, that's a defense lawyer. However, various observers of the court, students, some from universities and some law professors and organizations with labels like Amnesty and Human Rights Watch, have said that false testimony is created in Rwanda and that it is organized and financed.
Yes, we even had an RPF intelligence officer testify in our trial and told the judges that he was in charge of arranging all the witnesses for the trials at the ICTR, and they were all scripted and all arranged, and all the cases were fixed.
And
that makes you wonder what really happened. Why would they need to fix witnesses if these events really happened the way they say? Because you'd have real witnesses.
Oh, that is an interesting question, which, by the way, you're out of order.
Right.
I have to ask you, Chris, isn't there a problem of legal culture? I worked at the ICTR over a period of time, and, of course, I worked in other cases brought in North America, Texas, Minnesota, et cetera. And there is always this problem that you start approaching court dates and they talk about who the judge is going to be and what the setting. And you hear people make reasoning such as, well, now this is Judge so-and-so. He's a pretty reasonable guy. We thought we were going to get what's-his-name, and that was not so good because his nickname is Chop Chop. And then there's a question. Someone says, well, we ought to go to bat on this. We have to say we don't want this kind of procedure. And then there'll be discussions saying, do we really want to get him mad right off the bat? Those kinds of things enter in, don't they?
Well, they do, but defense lawyers always have to consider the best interest of the client. I mean, you can't give up certain central points at the beginning of the trial because then you're lost on fear of maybe angering the judge or something or annoying the judge. Mm-hmm. If you've got a valid point, the judge won't be angry when you're bringing it. Mm-hmm. And this is nonsense. I heard that 2 weeks ago, they abandoned a jury trial and went by judge alone, which is very rarely done in a murder trial. This is a murder trial. The only chance, I think, might be, well, the best chance an accused has in a major charge like that is a jury, because ordinary lay people are not taken in so easily by these antics. They don't like it.
Well, also the concept of, you know, trial by peers, people who live their own, they live lives too, and they don't, they're not lawyers and judges, but they also have experiences, and when they listen, they get a sense of whether somebody's telling the truth or not, or there's something about the quality of evidence, some of whom have heard similar evidence against members of their families and such.
Right. And going through a judge alone, it may be, even the best judge in this culture right now in Canada, with the Supreme Court decisions and everything else that's gone on with Mugesera and so on, the influence of Louise Arbour, the negative influence, there's a certain culture where they tend to believe the version the RPF puts out of what happened in Rwanda. Therefore, if this man's accused of doing this, probably it's true. That's what's in their mind. With a jury who doesn't really know much, except, and many people I've spoke to don't even know what happened in Rwanda at all. You get a jury in there, you got more of a chance of influencing 12 people than one. You can swing some over. And then people start opening their minds. A judge, even the best judge, can be influenced by various means.
What was our great movie or court that we all used to watch?
And the 12 Angry Men.
The 12 Angry Men. I mean, that was a beautiful
example
of what you're saying.
Right.
Where they didn't, well, they started off buying into the story.
Right.
But somebody had one small problem.
And
out of that came new. But as you point out, there's a built-in problem here, because for some reason this court believes already that there would be physical threats to witnesses when there no one has demonstrated that to the court.
That's right. So
you're already on a you're sort of on the wrong side of the mountain.
Right. And normally in a murder case, if the prosecution wants to bring in a witness who's under threat, usually in these biker trials or something like that, or a murder, the prosecution has to make an application and say, we want to bring him in or her in as Madam or Mr. X. And they have to have very valid, strong reasons for doing so. And there's usually a small hearing within the trial to discuss that. So every witness should be treated like this, not have a blanket decision where they're all brought in, this is the way it's going to be done because it's done at the ICTR, because that was a farce. Yeah. But I understand I read the press report that the defense counsel said that the reason they've abandoned the jury is it was too risky to go in front of a jury without knowing how it would be instructed by the judge in a complicated case like this.
Yeah,
well, that's true in all murder cases. You never know how the judge is really going to instruct the jury because you don't know all the facts.
Well, as a matter of fact, we know of murder cases where the judge instructs and the lawyers get on their feet when the jury leaves and they say, Your Honor, you have to bring them back here.
Right, for further instructions. And sometimes in complicated cases, you can set it down, like they complained about, well, it's a murder, but then it's genocide, and they could arrive at genocide with all different routes. Well, it wouldn't be that way. You just ask the jury, did this man commit murders against these people, yes or no? Is that genocide, step two, yes or no? And you could compartmentalize it like that by asking the jury certain questions. I don't see the problem myself. So it's for a major murder trial, I think it's unusual to abandon a jury.
Yeah. Incidentally, we have had a previous case, and I'm speaking in the dark. I don't recall whether they had a jury or not in the case in Montreal.
I don't think so.
I don't think they did either.
I think this was going to be the first jury trial of one of these types of cases. Now that's being just abandoned, and it's a tragedy, I think, or I'm not the defense counsel. Maybe they know things I don't.
They're on the scene and they know what they want to do. But it is certainly interesting. And by the way, but the Canadians themselves should be concerned, because when we start down the road and say, don't worry about him being tried over there because there's arguments. Actually, by the way, even the Canadian government is highly critical of some of the proceedings and behavior of Rwanda. And allegedly they're watching close in the Mugesera matter because they turned him over. However, there is a kind of conceit that says, oh, well, we'll do it right. Then you start hearing sort of little bumps, and then you say, well, if we're going to do it the Canadian way, why are we doing it the Arusha ICTR way?
Exactly.
I think we ought to be asked. Certainly Canadians better start being concerned because there could be some other people on trial here. And this becomes a precedent. And apropos of that, and I remind you again, this is Chris Black, a Toronto lawyer who has represented an accused before the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. That was General Ndendelimana, a very celebrated case, a very important case. Chris, Charles Taylor was defended recently by Courtney Griffiths, a brilliant British lawyer.
Right.
He has been, very unimpressed with the International Tribunal for Sierra Leone that he was before. But there was a moment at the end of the trial when the decision was rendered, a Judge So spoke up suddenly. Will you talk about that and what your thoughts are about it?
Right. Judge So was an alternate judge on the panel. In case one of them became ill, so he would step in. He gave a dissenting opinion. When they were reading the judgment on the day of the judgment in public, and the press was there, and they read the judgment, he said he wanted to read a dissent. And he began reading the dissent, and it said basically that he said there was no evidence against the accused, or not enough to surmount the burden of reasonable doubt, and that the trial had several irregularities, and it was a farce, and he went further and said it was a travesty and a scandal for nadir of international justice. That if this is how an international justice was going to operate, then it was almost the death of international justice. It was very strong language.
Mm-hmm.
Now, while he was saying that, they cut his microphone off, and the other judges walked out. And we only know what he said because of one of the journalists in the courtroom. He kept speaking despite the fact his microphone was cut off, and she recorded. He recorded the words and broadcast it on the report. It didn't make the mass media.
That's not something that we don't need to know, and we are looked after by our the media. It's like our uncle.
Right.
By the way, you've given me an opportunity about a line I've been wanting to use. So they use curtains at a show trial.
Exactly. It's like fortunately, put a hook in and just hooked them up. I mean. And the other question is, where does Charles Taylor appeal? I don't know what the appeal structure is there. He has an appeal, but that dissent would give him a very strong appeal, with one of the judges saying there was no evidence against him.
By the way, don't you suppose that in a way that's why they wanted they were probably praying there'd be no record of that?
Yes, I'm sure they would try to cut it off so nobody would ever know he actually said what he said, and he would just be silenced.
Nominating him for an International Jurist Award for honesty, character, integrity, and of course, I'm also helping with his resume because he'll never work again in that capacity.
It's very courageous for him to have done that. It took a lot of. It's maybe surprising for people to think it takes courage for a judge to do his job in that international setting where it's all supposed to be, ivory tower, but it's not. It's a very dirty world. So,
Indeed. You have seen of course, within at the tribunal so a sufficient amount of time that you've seen judges in terrible problems there and having great problems of conscience.
Yes, right. There was two cases of judges at the ICTR who acquitted a man and they were never reelected. They were kicked out of the tribunal for that. Other judges have resigned.
Yeah.
I mean, there's all sorts of scandals going on, but people don't know about it.
Well, incidentally, again, we must understand that, of course, there we have politics and we have law, but also we have the politics of law, and we have and within every field, whether you're speaking of defense counsel or prosecutors or judges, those are highly politicized environments.
Right. Which I was naive in, when I was a young lawyer and lost, I didn't quite get that. you thought that law, when you became a lawyer, judges, even the worst, somehow were inherently fair, and really may have biases, but were inherently trying to be impartial despite themselves. But that's not the case with a lot of these judges. International tribunals, they seem to be just being paid to have an agenda.
Yeah. Now, this is Chris Black, and now we have to ask you another question about the curious workings of the International Criminal Tribunal.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, you very very successful in defense of the general, and he as my understanding is that they made one or two findings of lesser offenses against him, sort of as, I have to tell you, in my own opinion, rationalizing why they had held him so many years and broken up his family and didn't permit him to be at his son's bedside when he died, such things as that. Then, now, his time has been served, yet he remains in Tanzania.
Right. He's along with several other people who have been acquitted, officers and major figures who have been acquitted. They are not being taken back to the countries in which they were arrested, where they had refugee status, France, Belgium, and other places, South Africa. So these countries will not take them back, even though they have refugee status in these places. And they were taken out of those countries under duress by the UN, and the countries cooperated with the UN, sent them out, so you would think that they would take them back once they were acquitted, but they're not doing that. So they're stuck in Tanzania in a safe house where they're at risk of being assassinated by the RPF.
Yes.
And it's simply the development of families. So.
Separate, I mean, yes, it is not inexpensive for someone to travel to see their loved one. And by the way, also not convenient, because that means crossing borders and being in areas which are dangerous even for family and friends.
Right. Most of these men have their families in Europe, so it's a long voyage if the families can afford the flights to go down there on vacation time, and it's very difficult. And there's been many efforts. General Didi Amana is maybe a bit, has an advantage over some of the others because he does have high-placed friends in Europe and Belgium, but even that hasn't worked. But they're still trying, like Colonel Marshall and others are trying to get him back into Belgium.
This has to do with the radioactivity around the charge, charges and the political cowardice of people. When, you know, the one thing we haven't reminded the listeners, or I didn't, was that they're presumed to have rights as well. And the rights, particularly of an acquitted person, is to resume his life, sometimes to be compensated.
Yeah.
The United Nations seems to be a failed state.
Yeah, it's totally washed its hands. It does nothing.
They're all very snobbish and all very superior, and yet they behave in a disreputable, dishonest way.
Yes.
When they removed some of those accused and brought them from various places in Europe and Africa, they assured the state from which they removed them that everything was going to be done properly. And they were simply going to be given a chance to defend themselves, and if found not guilty, that, of course, they would resume their lives.
Right.
But that's a lie.
Exactly, because each country signed a note of agreement with the tribunal stating that they would cooperate with the tribunal in every regard. So if the tribunal, the president of the tribunal, said, these men have been acquitted, you must take them back, then they, under that agreement, they must take them back. But the tribunal, the UN, does not write such letters. Does not do anything. Though the Security Council, I understand, passed some sort of minor resolution recommending that they be allowed back, but it hasn't been acted on. So these men are just stuck there. I mean, one man's been in a safe house for like 7 years. In Tangarura, Kabiligi was acquitted, 2 years ago. Prote Zigiziranyu another year ago. And the general's been out now for several months.
Yeah. Now, this is...
This is a man who, on record, saved many, many countless Tutsis, and that he can't get back.
Yeah. Now, this is, we really have to underline it, that this is where Canadians are supposed to speak up and say, make the UN live by its rules and by its undertakings. Otherwise, don't cooperate with it. It turns out to be a kind of a mediocre state full of corrupt people who don't respect people's rights.
Well, yeah, it's more than that, because, in fact, the UN is being used by certain powers, we all know, for their interests. So these agencies, these organizations, which I think are set up illegitimately, like the Hague and the Rwanda Tribunal, they're used for the purposes of those big powers, mainly the United States in this case.
Which, in the case of the ICC, 10 years, and only Africans have been accused.
Right, only Africans, and Lubanga was convicted for doing nothing. They accused him of, they convicted him of engaging child soldiers, but he was the one man in the Ituri region in the Congo who tried to stop that, and he had created peace in that sector of the Congo. Mm-hmm. And then that's why he was really arrested, because they didn't want peace there. They want chaos there so they can extract minerals without interference by any state.
Anybody bothering them.
Right.
Yes.
So his counsel, Jean Flamme, left in protest Lebanga's mm-hmm. case because of that. And now the ICC, they've cut the legal aid budget for those who don't have money so low that no lawyer can work there. It's one unbelievable.
You mean no funds for defense?
They've cut the hourly rate down from what it was at the ICTR, which is already low for these kinds of cases, lawyers of our experience, to half that.
Uh-huh.
and you can't defend these cases on that kind of money. And there's no money for investigators to go into the region. If you get maybe a certain number of hours and 3 months to do it, and it's impossible.
I'm picking up the pattern that they are emulating the American system where a black unemployed accused can't get a lawyer.
Exactly.
So if they're simply replicating their home base.
Yes.
Well, that's been very informative, Chris. I appreciate it all.
You're welcome.
Regards to your client who deserves to be home with his family, and you did a great job. Thank you very, very much.
Yeah, thank you very much also.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
That's Chris Black, who did represent, and I incidentally try to access the trial. It's quite enlightening. You're listening to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, and you can check us out. This program, for example, and others previous are at taylor-report.com. And, Phil, you were going to say something.
Yeah, actually,
this
Phil
Connelly.
We, at the top of the program, we talked about the hunger strike, the Palestinian prisoners, and Nakba is coming up. There is a report in the U.S. papers in the Los Angeles Times that this afternoon there has been a settlement between the Palestinian Authority and the Israeli authorities to bring an end to the hunger strike, and that according to what the Palestinian president is saying, the Israelis have made some significant concessions, especially in the issue of the families of people from Gaza being allowed to visit the prisoners who are being held in the West Bank. So this is reported in the L.A. Times
just
two hours ago. Right?
Just 2 hours.
Yeah.
That's we want to all know the terms. By the way, we hope to be speaking to someone in Montreal about the maybe settlements or developments there with students. Big things are happening, and they're happening very fast. And it's always interesting, by the way, we do this kind of program, and you walk in the door, and about halfway through the program, the scene changes. But I should tell you, by the way, we were going to speak to someone in Zambia at the beginning of the show today, but weren't able to reach that person. There they have a related problem to that which we've been discussing. And I know many of our listeners are from East Africa, from Somalia, from Ethiopia, Eritrea, and they live with this issue in Rwanda, Burundi, many refugees, and they're a really desperate situation. Anybody outside his country who has refugee status or is seeking it, it's a life or death matter. In the case of Zambia, there are, I think, about 6,000, that's probably ballpark in any event, Rwandan refugees. And the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees, for no reasons known to them, have changed the status of the refugees and is now putting them in a new category where they are losing their refugee status. And so that means they're in limbo. And nobody is explaining to them how this could be. A stroke of the pen takes away makes your life relatively safe. And this has happened in to Rwandans. Incidentally, it's Rwandans. As we point out in this program, there are also Angolans and Zimbabweans and others in Zambia. They don't fall under this. So, yes, you're right, listener. It's politics. That there is some kind of special relationship between these two governments. Now, remember, the people who said that they were refugees are the United Nations. And before they can remove that status of refugee, it's supposed to be the state that is harboring them, protecting them, because they enter into an agreement. They have to investigate themselves because they can't put somebody at risk. You can't throw somebody across the border into the fire. At least you're not legally. One organization has pointed out, this was done without the state of Zambia in doing any investigating. They simply did it. We're going to be we can take a break here and come back because I think I have misplaced the correct identification of someone. We're going to take a break, and this is Tater Report B, and we'll be right back.
From the roots up, CIUT 89.5 FM, Toronto.
Tater Report, 89.5 FM, and this is Phil Taylor, and we are attempting to reach one of the student leaders in, or was a student, let's put it this way, a student activist in Quebec, where they are having, at this moment, one of the great student demonstrations, movements in modern history, probably in Canadian history, where the battle is over tuition and the increases, dramatic increase in tuition introduced by the Premier, Mr. Charest, who was the people's choice of English Canada to go to Quebec to handle the situation there and explain to him about how economics is run in English Canada. Anyhow, the Parliament all applauded and sent him off, and he's been there for years now. But he seems to run into a problem in that the students of Quebec who have, through their political activity and involvement in the broader community, particularly with trade unions, have been able to have levels of tuition which are the best in Canada, and it's a kind of system more resembling some in Europe, and they are proud of it, and they don't just throw it away lightly. I think Tom Walkham in the Toronto Star pointed out that in Norway they don't have tuition for higher learning. The question is your degree of whether you have qualified, and if you've got the scores and talent, you're there. And people say, oh, well, that's because Norway has found a lot of oil. But Tom Walkham pointed out that they didn't find oil, they found taxation, and that they agreed they want a certain type of, they want higher learning for all, and that's how they have achieved it. The Quebec population, they may be divided. I don't know. The students don't seem to be divided. They have really fabulous political leadership, and I'm afraid we're not going to be able to reach today to speak to that student. But we sure want to talk about that or make sure people understand it, how there's a political culture has developed there, which is special. It probably has something to do with the way the country was founded. It has something to do with ideas about British and system and its history, and the role of the French in North America, and the battle that has always been waged for an identity, which is highly democratic, and this particularly in this period of history has been exceptional. These student demonstrations are simply a reflection of that. And Phil, I think
you know, there's a historical point on this that I find very interesting. In 1960, which is the year they say that the Quiet Revolution in Quebec started, and two very, very people who became extremely prominent in Quebec politics subsequently were involved in the question of researching education in Quebec, and that was both Jacques Parizeau and René Lévesque in different areas of the question. They said, except for Portugal, which we must remember was under a fascist dictatorship at the time, no other country in the West had a lower level of education of the general population. No other country had a smaller percentage of people who had graduated from universities or had finished high schools. This is what Quebec was in 1960.
Before Quebec.
Before
and the Quiet Revolution.
And before the Quiet Revolution. Mm-hmm. So this is a society that has come a tremendous amount in a very, very short period of time. They pointed out, for instance, that Ontario revolutionized education in the 1850s, right? Mm-hmm. So here it was 100 years later in Quebec, and you had a handful of a small handful of elite people who went to the Jesuits and were trained to lead the society, and everybody else was trained to go to work and do a menial job. I mean, and that was, they said, no, this has to change. We want to have an educated population. We want society to go to school. And it was always understood that the goal was universal free higher education. And as a step towards that, they expanded the university system, they brought in the SACEP system, and they always kept the tuition low. But the long-term goal was always free. And then all of a sudden, that goal got vaguer and vaguer with the succeeding governments, and then all of a sudden the Liberals discovered this year, my God, we don't collect as much money as the guys in the rest of Canada do, so we have to do something about that. Right? And then students who seem to have studied history, which for the right-wingers that's always a problem. You don't want people studying history. They said, that's the wrong direction. That's not the direction we're supposed to be going in.
Yeah. Yes. No. Yeah, it is always a good time to revisit how these things evolved. And you know, on this program, we spoke with Eve Engler, who has this great study of Lester Pearson. and by the way, our sense of how broad-minded everybody is, and how we go by mutual respect between countries, and we're a big country like all the other big countries, and we have a lot of freedom, et cetera. And Charles de Gaulle visited here, gave a little speech in Quebec City. And he said it, one line, Vive Québec libre. And suddenly, if you see the pictures of that moment, even policemen in the street were throwing their hats in the air. And Lester Pearson told de Gaulle that he must leave. He was talking to the president of France. You must leave now. Or otherwise, of course, there were certain friends, people around Pearson would have burned him at the stake. If something was revealed to us about the history of North America, it was quite a moment. And now we have these other, like we have hemispheric questions. The British are once again saying the Falklands belongs to Her Highness. And the Argentines say no. They said that's the Malvinas and they must be returned. And we want your warships, by the way, out of our region. And they, of course, now one of our princes, I think, is going to fly a helicopter down there and straighten everything out. But I recall that when everyone here said Falklands, 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 what about the Falklands? The Falklands is the Falklands that. But the premier of Quebec, his name was René Lévesque, he said, oh, well, of course, the Argentines are correct about the Malouines. The original European name was the French Malouine. Then the Spanish was Malvinas. But, we need that insight, that way of looking, because everybody else had begun to go back to their British accents or something.
Well, and during the first Malvinas War, the second one, whatever it was, but 30 years ago in 1982, there was a very telling moment. I would only call it editorial interference in the independence of the CBC or Radio Canada, when a conservative member of the House of Commons got up and complained that the French announcers on Radio Canada were referring to them as Les Îles Malouines and not as Les Îles Falkland. And, of course, it was explained to them that nobody in French would understand what you meant by Les Îles Falkland. And they said, we don't care. On the CBC, you're going to say Falkland. You're not going to say Malvinas.
I mean, we don't have state.
That was a there's moment.
No, there's no state interference here. I mean, that's a beauty, you know. For example, if Mr. Freeman or Mr. Black want to return to Canada, they both have an equal shot. If they're both lords.
Right.
I really have to point out, do you remember Oscar Levant?
I do.
Well, Oscar Levant made a comment about Bernard Baruch that might apply to the Lord Black. Levant said, you know, people are critical of Bernard Baruch, a millionaire, sits and feeds the pigeons in New York, and people watch him because he's a multimillionaire, and they think he's brilliant. And he said, well, he says, you have to give him credit. I mean, he did. He said, you know, he started with a mere $10 million, and he ran it into a fortune. So, yes, we need to revisit the historical reality. And you talk about being on the right side or wrong side of history. South America knows what they think of this. And Fidel Castro reminded everybody. Incidentally, Fidel shone brightly during the struggle around the Malvinas. I don't know that other word. And he stood up at the time that Argentina confronted Britain over the question of sovereignty of the Malvinas. And suddenly everybody in South America remembered how great it is to have an independent leader who is not intimidated by the junkies. That's J-A-N-K-I-S. And he was embraced by a bunch of people in Argentina who never thought they would even want to say hello to him because he's a terrible Bolshevik. But boy, did they love Fidel. That was a tremendous moment. And they're returning to that now. They, you know, the South Americans are agreed. But there's one other detail, too, to always remember, and that is the Belgrano. It is a troop ship of the Argentines that was outside the area of combat, outside the combat zone, or if it was not outside, it was cruising in to leave that zone. I think it had 600 men aboard.
And many of whom were teenage draftees.
Yes, and it was sunk by the British on the orders of the famous Prime Minister.
On the orders of Margaret Thatcher, who was refusing to take a phone call from a third-party diplomat, I think a Peruvian, who was trying to arrange a ceasefire. And yeah. She said, we're going to sink the Belgrano, then we'll talk to them about a ceasefire.
Yeah, this was, she believed, and there are elements in U.S., British, French ruling circles who always think it's time for the buckshot, you know, and she was one of those. And as pointed out around the world, the Italians noticed when they looked at the death list, because, of course, about, 50% of the population of Argentina is of Italian origin. So those names all looked like they were from Italy. And they did not have to die at all. I mean, that was a total, terrible loss of life. Well, I think we've covered everything. I want to thank Chris Black for having joined us, and Phil Conlon, who, again, Classical Underground, tomorrow, 12 o'clock.
Thank you. And, yes, please be there.
Well, I thank myself for getting it right. This is Phil Taylor for the Taylor Report. It's CIUT. It's 89.5 FM. You can write to us, taylor@ciut.fm, or check us out, taylor-report.com. And I'm going to say again that we really missed the great John Harris, who was buried today in Birmingham. See you next week.